This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio today by
Audrey Raj.
And yet again by
Christine Wong.
We are going to be with you all the way through until 1 p.m. this afternoon. Thank you, Sabrina, for the news, by the way. Moving on then, stories that we've got lined up for you today. We're going to be talking a little bit about facial recognition and AirAsia. They've become involved in some new tech. We have updates about a PS4 update that will let parents control how long their kids can play for. Tech addiction, we'll be talking a little bit about that. Audrey's talking to us about what Facebook and Google vets will be doing. Mm-hmm. We then will be moving on to an app that tells you what to eat based on how you feel, potentially saving marriages and relationships worldwide. And then we'll be wrapping up with some genomes and some blockchains. If you want to get in touch via the show, you can get us on WhatsApp. Audrey is driving WhatsApp. It is 018-789-8899. Or Twitter, which Christine is handling. It is at BFM. Do not forget, that's all on Twitter, of course. Right.
At BFM Radio.
That's
at
what
BFM
I meant.
Radio.
Did I not finish that?
No.
I did not. Oh, okay, sorry. At BFM Radio. I'll say it again. At BFM Radio. Right, let's start off with this story. AirAsia being the first airline in Asia to speed up plane boarding with facial recognition. I'm just going to leave it for a pause there. AirAsia and boarding recognition. Right, okay. There we go. So they've officially launched what they call the Fast Airport Clearance Experience System, also known as FACES. At Senai International Airport in JB, which will enable passengers to board their flight faster. Using facial recognition technology, it eliminates the need of showing your boarding pass and ID at the departure gate. So far, so good. Mm-hmm. With its automated boarding gate, the entire process of boarding about 180 passengers will take between 9 and 11 minutes instead of 11 to 13 minutes. With the current process, slightly faster, and it matters a lot for an airline like AirAsia, which has a turnaround of just 25 minutes. So this solution is run by a company called Gunnabo, and they're told we're told that the facial recognition system has a success rate of 98%, originally quoted at 80%. So at the moment, FACES will only work with adults aged 18 and above. For other passengers, including those traveling with infants or those requiring additional assistance, they need to go through the standard security screening and boarding process. Younger passengers aged between 18 are not permitted as their facial features are not fully developed, and this would, of course, affect its reliability. To begin with, you need to enroll yourself in the system with either your MyCard or your passport. It just takes 30 seconds to enroll at the kiosk and can be done at any time before or after the check-in counter is closed. Once that's done, you just proceed with the usual security and immigration clearance and head to the boarding gates. You will still need a printed boarding pass or mobile check-in QR code as it's still required by the authorities. Apparently, passengers will be clear between 1.5 to 4 seconds, and if there are any issues, you can still proceed with the manual process through the AirAsia staff. At the minute, there's only one kiosk at the self-check-in area down there in JB, and that's it so far. What do we think?
I want to know about twins.
Identical twins. Yeah, very good question. All right.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering if, like, you know,
yeah,
my girls are going to be able to get through this.
That is really interesting. Yeah, never thought about that. Christine?
And on that note, I was also thinking, what about people with glasses who don't have glasses in their ID photos?
Another good question, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, how are they going to recognize that? And also, like, do you have to take off things like the same thing, like hats and glasses and sunglasses and all this stuff when you go into this facial recognition thing? And, I mean, the thing is, right, I'm very appreciative of any kind of system that is trying to make especially airport admin more efficient.
Yes.
You know, so that is exciting. But also the fact that they only have one kiosk. And if people hear about this and they want to, you know, sign up and enroll themselves in the system, they have one kiosk.
Well, I mean, it's more likely it's a test bench right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not exactly a small airport, but
yeah.
I'd imagine that that's what they're doing. My kind of worry, I should say, is that this kind of software can be quite glitchy at the beginning, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the self-checking software is already fairly glitchy sometimes and doesn't always work. And something like this, I fear, at the beginning, might cause a few little errors. But then eventually when it's enrolled out, then it's a little bit more efficient. I can see it being, you know, fairly useful, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I think so as well. And, you know, I think that's a really big part of, you know, the kind of flight process that people hate, right, is waiting in queues for ages and ages. And if you can just step into somewhere, face scan, move on, that would be really great.
Yeah.
So I can't help but wonder, though, you know, if AirAsia might use this for nefarious purposes. As with any kind of company that's using facial recognition or any government that's using facial recognition, anything, I'm always just a bit cautious just because what are they keeping behind?
Yeah, so AirAsia is the first airline in Asia to introduce this, right? But I know Delta and JetBlue in the U.S., they've been doing this since, I think, last summer. They launched trials mid last year. This is because, you know, long lines have plagued airports thanks to a combination of more travelers and fewer frontline screeners. You know, everyone's cutting down. Mm-hmm. The TSA had its busiest summer on record in 2017. They screened more than 239 million passengers between, like, Memorial Day and Labor Day. And that's an increase of, like, 9 million passengers for... So a system like this could really be prove beneficial during heavy traveling periods like this, right?
Right.
But just for AirAsia,
Well, it's a step,
right?
It's
a step up, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen similar systems being tested in, I think, Heathrow last year. And, you know, the auto gates at Heathrow are actually pretty reliable, and it's pretty efficient so far. Mm. I don't know how much more efficient it will be with facial recognition software, though. I don't know.
So this is the thing. It says here that now, with this with the FACES system, passengers will take between 9 and 11 minutes to board instead of 11 to 13 minutes, which is, well, pretty much, it's not really making that much of a difference. But if you're catering to 9 million passengers...
Yeah, I was just about to say,
like, exponentially, that number, even though it's a few minutes for each individual, in general, it will save a lot of time. Mm. So that will be really good. I mean, for me, you know, with AirAsia specifically, because there are auto gates and stuff like that, but I would like to see how this works in, like, KLIA, for example, when there are so many people going to so many different places. And, you know, and also because we have a distinction, right, between the auto gates for local people and the not auto gates for foreigners.
Not local people.
Yes, right? So I would be curious to see, you know, how they would implement that and how, you know, it's still going to be a distinction between those lines now that, you know, there's this new efficient system in place.
Interesting stuff. Okay, let us know what you think. Get us on Twitter. We're at BFM Radio. And we're also on WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Moving on to our next story, PS4 update, letting parents control how long their kids can play. Good or not?
Yes.
Yes. Oh. Okay.
See, all right. So, as Rich has said, Sony's latest PlayStation 4 update, their system software update 5.50, includes a new feature called Playtime Management, as well as various other changes to the library interface, the ability to add custom wallpapers, and a super sampling mode that makes 4K games look better on 1080p TVs.
Useful if you don't have one of those fancy 4K TVs.
Yes. However, the main kind of aspect of this Playtime Management feature, which gives what they call family managers or any other adult family members who are set as guardians the ability to not only set limits on their kids' play time, but also to decide which games they're playing and or watching.
Ooh.
So family managers can set their kids' play time limits on the PS4 itself or through PSN on the web, and also so as not to, and I'm quoting this from the article, surprise kids in the middle of a sick run. Playtime management will warn kids that their time is running short so they can finish up and save, which... having played some video games myself where you are not allowed to save during some parts of the game can be very frustrating.
It can be, yes.
But anyways, I don't know about this. I think the limits on the kids' play time is totally fine, and I really appreciate that because you can get just sucked into hours and hours of play time, which is not good for you or your eyes or your mental health or anything.
Or your soul.
You know, and lest you, you know, lapse into the stereotype of the Mountain Dew and Doritos, like, you know, 24-hour gaming marathon thing. But I'm concerned a little bit about the which games they're playing and or watching thing, because surely you should just be buying games that they can play and or watch already. There are age restrictions on video games for a reason, you know. There's a reason why you don't give, like, 13-year-olds Grand Theft Auto. Right?
Right.
So I don't really know about that. And also to watch the games, you know, I don't know if that's going to, like, prevent people from, like, let's say you want to just explore and see, like, what new games there might be. But there might be a filter that says, like, hey, you can't see the games that you haven't already bought, for example. Right. So I don't really know how this is going to work.
Well, I think that's because most families actually share their PlayStation.
They do.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you've got an older family member who's just, say, I don't know, 35, playing with someone who's 12.
That's not old.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, the beauty is, though, with PlayStation, you can create multiple accounts. So you can have an adult log in for people who are over 35.
Stop rolling your eyes at me, Rich.
Suggested. And you can have, you know, another kind of login for people who are younger. And I think that's enough. But the idea of kind of monitoring what a child can and can't do on a PlayStation, I think, is solely down to the parents, you know.
Yeah.
But the idea that... Sony are acting as a de facto gatekeeper, I think is also very useful for a lot of parents who might not, you know, be able to monitor their kids 24/7.
And as a company as well, I think it's a good move for Sony and their publicity just to address the fact that there is a big problem with video game addiction anyway, you know, and to try and fix that and say like, hey, you know, now we do have this feature that is built into the system so that you can kind of like, you know, enforce these rules a bit stricter. So I think, you know, from a marketing perspective, that it's a genius move, quite frankly.
All right. Well, we've got some another story coming up a little bit later on that kind of deals with tech addiction. So I suppose it's kind of related. That's coming up in just a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere then, because when we come back, it is that story, how Facebook and Google vets form a coalition to fight tech addiction. That's all coming up after the break. And if you do want to get in touch with the show, don't forget you can do it via Twitter. We are at BFM Radio or 018-789-8899 on WhatsApp, of course. Some music coming up from The Walkman. It is Little House of Savages right here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes. I'm Rich Bradbury. This is
Christine Wong
and Audrey Raj.
We're going to be with you all the way through until 1 o'clock, coming in your ears. We have another story coming up next. It is Facebook, Google, and vets. Not Google vets, but veterans. They'll be forming a coalition to fight tech addiction. And it's time to talk about tech addiction, right?
Yes. So a group of former Apple, Facebook, and Google employees have formed an anti-tech addiction coalition called the Center for Humane Technology.
Can I just stop you there?
Sure.
Wait. Those companies, right? So Facebook, Google, and whom?
And Apple.
These are the ones that gave us tech addiction, arguably, in the first place, right?
Yeah.
All right, okay. Yeah. Sorry, just wanted to clarify.
At least, you know, they're trying to like slap a Band-Aid on the problem now, right?
Exactly right.
So let me just stress here. A group of former Apple, Facebook, and Google employees have formed a coalition called the Center for Humane Technology. So their website rings like this, okay? Our society is being hijacked by technology. What began as a race to monetize our attention is now eroding the pillars of our society, mental health, democracy, social relationships, and our children.
Oh, wow.
Sounds pretty serious, right?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My heart's thumping and all. Well, so the center has been organizing leaders and raising awareness since 2014, but it's taken a big step by announcing this week efforts to implement a tech addiction ad campaign targeted at 55,000 U.S. public schools. Mm. So it's called the Truth About Tech campaign, and it's designed to inform parents, teachers, and students about the potentially harmful effects of technology. In particular, the coalition is concerned about how time spent with a face buried in your smartphone or obsessed with virtual interactions such as likes and shares, how it can contribute to anxiety, depression, shorten attention spans, sleep deprivation, and affect the healthy social development of young minds.
This is something we've been talking about for a long time, right?
Yes, it has. And now let's talk about the people who are involved. There are some big names involved. The center's executive director and co-founder is Tristan Harris, formerly from Google. Its leadership, advisors and supporters also include early Facebook investor Roger McNamee, former Apple and Google communications exec Lynn Fox, former Facebook execs Dave Morin and Sandy Parakilas, Lyft president John Zimmer, and Asana co-founder Justin Rosenstein, yeah, who created Facebook's like button.
Oh, my word.
Ha.
So hang on a minute. So but Facebook and YouTube, they've already had backlash over kid-focused apps. So we've had Messenger Kids. We've had YouTube Kids.
Yep.
They had a bit of a scandal last year over disturbing and exploitative ads on their main service. So, you know, these are all perpetrators of the problem that they are kind of... I don't know how to feel about this, you know?
Also, Apple, I think more specifically, iPhone addiction is becoming a problem. Some analysts believe smartphones may be having unintentional negative consequences on young users and a growing societal unease that they feel could ultimately impact profits. So Apple is now planning a new, they too are planning parental controls for iOS devices. So they recognize that this is a problem too.
Mm. Christine.
So, I mean, I definitely think this is a problem. And to me, this is reading very kind of hilariously like some sort of a young adult book rebellion against you know, the man. But I do agree. I think it's a big problem. But what my concern is, like, how is this ad campaign going to play out? Are they going to start giving talks at schools and stuff? Or is this going to be, like, ironically an ad run
and if,
on
and if you
technology?
Missed, if you
like,
missed the lecture, you can always catch it on YouTube.
Right? So I'm kind of curious to see where they're going to draw the line. Because I think that you... with this kind of issue, the problem is that you're kind of at either end of the extremes, right? It's either you are going to be addicted to technology and technology is bad, or, you know, technology is useful and stuff. So I want to see exactly which, you know, how they're going to deal with this argument, because I think in today's day and age as well, kids can't really survive without technology in the first place.
Right,
you know?
Agreed.
Because
agreed.
While it contributes to, you know, feelings of anxiety, depression and stuff, it is also on a social level, you know, it does help for you to connect with other people, you know, not necessarily in the way that you're face to face with them or anything like that, but it does help. And I think, you know, cutting it out completely will lead to like ostracism in today's society for kids. But it's really about, I think, as long as they're educating people and trying to say, okay, you know, this isn't the be all end all of your interaction with technology, right? You shouldn't have to rely on it so much, but it is useful in a lot of ways.
So I don't know much about what this Truth About Tech campaign is going to be like, but I know that it is modeled on the anti-smoking campaigns in the States.
They're the ones that started right in the late 70s, early 80s, right?
So in the meantime, the first federal study of internet addiction is already underway by the National Institutes of Health. This is to determine whether tech addiction, specifically online gaming, should be listed as an official mental disorder. The two-year study should wrap up in 2018. And ironically, this comes at a time when Malaysia is thinking about introducing esports as part of the school, co-curricular syllabus. So go figure.
Are they really?
Yeah. That's what we were talking about yesterday on the evening edition. I missed
that. Right. That's a great thing to be doing. But like you were saying, Christine, the idea of like ostracizing kids because of how fast this technology has come up and how much we've embraced it to use, you know, it is going to be a real struggle to kind of, a bit of a minefield, really. I know we have had a WhatsApp message, right?
Yes. So Khairul Nizam says, as a gaming parent, I like the parental control features by Sony. I want my kids to play video games, but some of my games are really not for children. So yeah, thumbs up. PS4.
Nice. Yeah. No, I think that's definitely, I would agree with that. I think that having the control and being able to at least, you know, I mean, I keep thinking about the YouTube scandal where, you know, even on YouTube Kids, a lot of very disturbing content popped up because it didn't get past the filters, right? So, you know, with the PS4 feature, I think that's going to be really useful for a lot of people.
All right. We have to take a short break. We've got some music coming up from Suede, but when we come back, do you not know what to eat? Well, there's an app for that. Of course there is. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Biz Bytes here on BFM 89.9.
Bankers, financiers, and moneymakers. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio by
Christine Wong
and Audrey Raj.
So we've been playing around a little bit, and of course we told you just a few minutes ago that there is an app to tell you what to eat based on how you feel. It's a local app that Audrey's going to tell us a little bit more about.
Yeah, so one of the toughest questions that me and the husband face almost every other day is what to eat.
Yeah.
And you know this question, it can ruin relationships.
Anything that?
Yeah.
No, don't tell me that.
Tell me what you want. Okay, right. So IPC Shopping Center have
the
come up,
IPC, the one at Damansara Mutiara.
Yes.
Mutiara Damansara even. Yes. The name of that French rock band. Yes.
So they've come up with an app. It's called the IPC Shopping Center app. And what it does is it provides shoppers with suggestions on places to dine and drink at its premises. But what it does is it ties in with how you're actually feeling. And how it does that is the app works with Spotify to create the what they call a mood menu, which analyzes the user's recent playback history to track their current mood. And then the user's moods are then matched with suitable flavors. And the app then suggests several dining outlets for the users to choose.
I wonder how smart this algorithm is. That's the first question. The second question is, or rather the second statement is, as you said, Christine, it's a genius piece of marketing to get people to download the app and play around with it.
Mainly because we've all downloaded it.
We've all had a bit of a little play. Audrey, has yours downloaded already?
No, it hasn't.
No? Okay,
a bit slow.
I know mine has, and I know Christine's has. So Christine, before you tell people what the suggestions were, give us a rough estimation of the kind of mood of the stuff that you were listening to.
Okay, so confession time. My Spotify is me listening to Broadway music, which is another thing about that is that it's all kind of different genres as well, because Broadway can kind of arrange in a lot of different moods. So I've been listening to like songs from Hamilton, Wicked, Rent, you know, Into the Heights, all this stuff. In the Heights, sorry. All of this different music. But the app has told me that I'm relaxed, apparently, with my Broadway playlists.
Okay, so that answers the first question about how accurate the algorithm is.
It says, your tracks tell us that you're chill. Which I disagree with on a fundamental level. The perfect meal for your worry-free mood should be more sour. And then it's recommended things to me like Thai food, laksa, Nando's, right. and chicken.
Mm. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, my playlist has kind of been a very chill. There's kind of been a bit of electronica in there and some acoustic music and one thing or another. So it told me that I'm sleepy. Which is about which is about right. It says, wake up, there's eating to do. The tastiest meal for your mood would be rich, fatty, and less sour. Feed your feelings at one of our outlets below. So it's given me stuff like oysters and hot wings and Taiwanese street snacks and chicken. And, of course, there's coffee on there.
Feed your feelings.
Feed your feelings.
That's it's dangerous.
Right.
Do not feed your feelings.
That's right. How I live my life, though, Audrey. So
emotional eating is a problem, people.
It is.
So, I mean, you're most probably wondering why moods, right? Well, according to a study, human moods have the ability to inhibit or accentuate certain flavors like sweet, salty, bitter, sour, savory. You know, sometimes you want something savory or something sweet. So our taste perception can be modulated by a variety of factors, and this includes our emotional response to pleasant or unpleasant real-life events. For instance, if we were able to show that positive emotions go along with an enhancement of our sweet tooth, while negative emotions occur alongside heightened perception of sour taste. So this may be why Arvin's always eating ice cream.
Yeah, because he's angry inside and hot and bothered and, you know, and... Right.
Yeah. I think
interesting, though.
It is interesting because, you know, your usual shopping mall apps just tell you about promotions and, well, you know, just tells you where your favorite shops are located. But this is a nice addition. And the next time I'm at IPC, I will definitely try this out.
Can you try another social experiment the next time you go there with your husband?
Mm-hmm.
Both of you listen to something on your playlist, right? And then get the suggestions for both of you and see if there is a correlation at some point on that list.
You know what it's going to tell us.
And that should be ideal,
right? You know what it's going to tell us to do, right? We're both going to be eating at different places.
Right. That could be. Yeah, you eat there, you eat there. Christine, anything more to add?
I mean, I would at least like to know which songs that they found in my playlist that they think correlates to this mood.
Right.
I think it would be interesting to see exactly which, you know, things, because I have a lot of different playlists on Spotify for different moods in the first place. Mm. So I'd be curious to see if that's going to change any of the choices that they make for me.
Interesting stuff. Right. We have to take a break. We've got some music coming up. We've got Jet with She's a Genius, followed by Feist with My Moon, My Man. And when we come back, final story of the day, a new company, they want to sequence your genome and let you share it on the blockchain. Interested or not? Take a short break. Here we are on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Because feelings matter. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes, ladies and gents. It's our final story of the day, and it's something I've been really interested in because it's completely confusing the heck out of me. Mm. First and foremost, it's a new company who want to sequence your genome and let you share it on the blockchain. That's the first thing that they've said. And then what they go on to say is that cryptocurrency in exchange for your genetic data sounds like a bit of a scam, but it's the premise behind a new company founding by a leading geneticist. Nebula Genomics says it plans to sequence your genome for under $1,000, give you insights about it, secure it using a blockchain, and allow you to do whatever you want with the data. Right? So that's the first thing. So when you pay to take a DNA test, I don't know if you know this, the company that does the testing, they own your genetic data. They own that information. Mm. Nebula want to sequence people's entire genomes and let them own it, allowing them to earn digital money by sharing it. So this, it was a white paper that was released yesterday. They say that the reason is because pharma and biotech companies need large genomic data to develop new drugs. Companies typically buy this data from academic institutions or other genetic testing companies, often for millions of dollars. They say it aims to eliminate the middleman so that people can sell their genomic data straight to drug companies and other data buyers. It interests the heck out of me, but it also scares the heck out of me, right? I mean, I like the idea of if I have a genetic test or I have my DNA kind of checked or whatever, sequenced, that I then own that information. Because that's how it should be, I would have thought, right?
Are you telling me that Nebula genomics? They're not going to keep a sample?
Well, that's the question, right?
Oh, come on.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, in my head, I'm like, well, Elon Musk has just launched a car into orbit with a spaceman sat in it playing David Bowie. You know, and as Christine said, he's quite clearly going to be some kind of supervillain.
I mean, honestly, if anyone can just send a rocket up into space for funsies, they're going to take over the world, please. Yeah. Let's be real.
But I mean, you know, I was honestly unclear about what happened when you did send off your stuff to be sequenced. I did not know that the companies then owned your data. And so having it on the blockchain, as we know, keeps it safe and secure and grants you access to it. And only if you grant other people access to that data do they have access to it then.
So that's why they need blockchain.
I think so, yeah. Because right. Before we were saying, well, why do we need blockchain? Why not just store it in a drawer or something?
Yeah.
But obviously, yeah.
Yeah, but why would you want... Well, why would you want it's one of this the, to
okay,
begin with?
Okay. So I'll give you an example. Let's imagine that you've decided to do a family history search and you want to know where your family comes from, you know, which part of the world do they come from.
That's why you have grandmothers to tell you stories.
Yes, your grandmothers start off, but then you might want to go back like a couple hundred years or, you know, 200-400 years, and genetics should be able to give us some kind of indicator as to a rough area of the world where we come from. Christine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in a place where this sounds like it's going to become the new, like, haha, sell a kidney because you want to earn some money and stuff, which I feel very uncomfortable about. On the one hand, you know, I'm just really in a place where this is all, it just sounds like they're just trying to take advantage of a lot of buzzwords being crammed into one headline. And
there is that too, yes.
And, you know, trying to
genetics,
to say
blockchain. And
yeah, you know, I don't feel comfortable about this at all. I don't feel like it's a necessary thing. I do, however, appreciate the attempt at kind of making the whole process a little bit more secure and allowing people to own their own data. But it's like, then just don't send that data in the first place, then your DNA is your own, I guess.
Well, coming back to their pitch, cryptocurrency in exchange for your genetic data, how are they paying? They're paying you in Bitcoin?
No,
or?
Nebula coin. It's their own coin.
Ah, so there will be an ICO to this too.
Possibly, very possibly, yes. And of course, as we know, most ICOs raise an awful lot of money very, very quickly, unless you're in America where you can't participate in ICOs, or China. So the rest of us will be funding the funding for this cryptocurrency, blockchain, genetics thing. See, I did all the buzzwords all in one go.
Yes, yeah. I think we would need to learn a lot more about exactly, you know, to look at the terms and conditions of this whole process and see exactly what, you know, claims that they're making, and, you know, if they have really outright promised that they're not going to keep any of your data, because I really, really highly doubt that they're going to stick by that.
So I was reading down this article and it says here, the pitch to the average person like me is that you're not just monetizing your genetic data, we're also going to provide you with insights. For example, Nebula will be able to tell you about your disease risks. Now that is interesting.
Yeah, useful. I mean, that's why a lot of people do get their DNA sequence. But the thing is, you know, we've just spoken about how if and when they go for an ICO or something like that. And a lot of these ICOs can be a little bit, you know, Wild West. You're not entirely sure about these people and whether or not you can trust them. These guys have put their names down. They are, a PhD student, a graduate called Kamal Obad, a geneticist called George Church. These are all from Harvard, you know, and there's a CEO of Veritas Genetics. It's somebody who's already involved in that kind of industry. So, you know, that kind of lifts that trust level up a little bit. But, you know, as you say...
Yeah, speaking of Veritas Genetics, right, they offer a genome sequencing service for $999.
Yeah.
Well, Nebula's goal is to set the price of genome sequencing below $1,000.
$999. Bargain. Right, that's all the time we have for today, of course. We need to wrap up, but we'll quickly run through the stories that we have covered just in case you missed any part of the show. And, of course, you can listen to it a little bit later on if you download the BFM app from the Apple App Store or from Google Play. We started off with facial recognition technology for AirAsia. You could well be boarding a plane just by staring into a screen.
And then we talked about how the new PS4 update lets parents control how long their kids can play and also what video games that they play as well.
Then we spoke about Facebook, Google and Apple veterans. They formed a coalition to fight tech addiction. something that they most probably started in the first place. Yes. All right.
They're literally raging against the machine.
Yeah. And then, of course, that story about the IPC shopping app that will tell you what you should eat based on how you feel.
And, of course, we wrapped up with a new company, how they want to sequence your genome and let you share it on the blockchain. Right, don't go anywhere, folks, because coming up after the 1 o'clock news, it is the Breakfast Grill replay. Very interesting. It's with Helen Clark, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand and the administrator of the UN Development Programme. So can the concepts of capitalism and sustainability be reconciled? On the sidelines of World Capital Market Symposium 2018, the Breakfast Grill tapped the former Prime Minister of New Zealand and administrator of the UN Development Programme for insight. They spoke to her about the UN Global Sustainable Development Goals and the UN's approach to solving global inequalities. My name is Rich Bradbury. On behalf of Audrey Raj and, of course, Christine Wong, this has been Enterprise Biz Bytes. We will be back tomorrow again at noon. In the meanwhile, we have some music coming up from Kula Shaker. It is Hush here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.